Chapter 9. When they reached the basement, Glimmung boomed a hearty greeting at them. "You don't need translating equipment," he informed them. "I'll speak to each of you telepathically in your own language." He filled almost all of the basement. They had to remain by the elevators. Now he had become more dense, more compact, but he still remained huge. Joe took a large, deep, steadying breath and said, "Are you going to pay the hotel compensation for the damage you've done?" "My check," Glimmung said, "will be in the mail by tomorrow morning." "Mr. Fernwright just meant that as a joke," Harper Baldwin said nervously, "about paying the hotel." "Joke?" Joe said. "Collapsing 10 floors of a 12-floor building? How do you know people weren't killed? There could be as many as 100 dead, plus a lot more injured." "No, no," Glimmung assured him. "I killed no one. But the query is legitimate, Mr. Fernwright." Joe felt the presence of Glimmung within him, stirring in his brain. Glimmung edged here and there throughout the most unusual corners of Joe's mind. "I wonder what he's looking for," Joe thought. And at once the answer within his consciousness came. "I'm interested in your reaction to the Book of the Kalends," Glimmung said. He spoke then to all of them. "Out of all of you, only Miss Yoyez knew about the book. The rest of you I'll need to study. It will only take a moment." The extension of Glimmung left Joe's mind then. It had gone elsewhere. Turning to Joe, Molly said, "I'm going to ask him a question." She, too, took a deep and steadying breath. "Glimmung," she said sharply, "tell me one thing. Are you going to die soon?" The enormous lump throbbed, its whip-like extremities thrashed in agitation. "Does it say that in the Book of the Kalends?" Glimmung demanded. "It does not. If I were, it would say." Molly said, "Then the book is infallible." "You have no reason to think I am near death," Glimmung said.
"None at all," Molly said. "I asked my question in order to learn something. I learned it."
"When I am depressed," Glimmung said, "I begin to think about the Book of the Kalends, and I think that their prediction that I cannot raise Heldskala is true. That in fact I can accomplish nothing. The cathedral will remain at the bottom of Mare Nostrum into eternity." Joe said, "But that's when your energy is low." "Each living entity," Glimmung said, "passes through periods of expansion and periods of contraction. The rhythm of living is as active in me as is any of you. I am larger, I am older. I can do many things that none of you even collectively can. But there are times when the sun is low in the sky, toward evening, before true night. Small lights come on here and there, but they are a long way off from me. Where I dwell, there are no lights. I could, of course, manufacture life, light, and activity around me, but they would be extensions of myself alone. This, of course, is changed now that you have begun to come here. The group today is the final group. Miss Molly Yoyez and Mr. Fernwright and Mr. Baldwin, and those with them, are the last who will be coming." "I wonder," Joe thought, "if we will leave this planet again." He thought about Earth and his life there. He thought about the game and his room with its dead black window. He thought about the government's Mickey Mouse money that came in baskets. He thought of Kate. "I won't be calling her again," he thought. "For some reason I know that. It is a fact. Probably because of Molly. Or, perhaps," he thought, "the larger situation. Glimmung and the undertaking." "And Glimmung's falling through the floor," he thought, "descending 10 stories and winding up in the basement. That meant something," he realized. And then he realized something else. Glimmung knew his weight. As Molly had said, no floor could hold him. Glimmung had done it on purpose. So we wouldn't be afraid of him, Joe realized, when we at last saw him as he really is. Then, he thought, we really should be afraid of him, perhaps, more so than before, just exactly because of this. "Afraid of me?" Glimmung's thought came. "Of the whole undertaking," Joe said. "There's too little chance of it being a success." "You're right," Glimmung said. "We're talking about chances, about possibilities, statistical probabilities. It may work, it may not. I don't claim to know. I'm only hoping. I have no certitude about the future. Nor does anyone else, including the Kalends. That is the basis of my entire position, and my intent."
Joe said, but to try and then to fail, is that so terrible? Glimmung said. I'll now tell you something about yourselves, something that every one of you possesses, a quality in common. You have met failure so often that you have all become afraid to fail.
I thought so, Joe thought.
Well, so it goes.
What I am doing, Glimmung said, is this. I am attempting to learn how much strength I have. There is no abstract way of determining the limits of one's force, one's ability to exert effort. It can only be measured in a way such as this, a task which brings into view the actual real limitation to my admittedly finite but great strength. Failure will tell me as much about myself as will success. Do you see that?
No, none of you can. You're paralyzed. That's why I brought you here. Self-knowledge, that is what I will achieve. And so will you. Each about himself.
Suppose we fail, Molly asked.
The self-knowledge will be there anyhow, Glimmung said. He sounded baffled, as if there was a gap between himself and the group of them.
You really do not understand, do you? He said to them all.
You will before it's over. Those of you, anyhow, who want to go through with it.
A fungiform lispingly asked, At this late point, do we still have the right to choose?
Any of you who wish to return to your own world are free to do so, Glimmung said. I will provide passage, first class, back. But those of you who do go back, you will find it once again as it was. And as it was, you could not live such a life. Each of you intended to destroy yourselves and were in the process of so doing when I found you. Remember, that is what lies behind you. Don't make it that which lies ahead of you.
There was an uncomfortable silence.
I'm leaving, Harper Baldwin said.
Several others moved closer to him, signifying that they would leave too.
What about you? Molly asked Joe.
Joe said, What's behind me is the police.
And death, he thought. The same as for you, for us all.
No, he said. I'm going to try. I'll take the chance that we fail. Maybe he's right. Maybe even failure is valuable. As he says, it tells us the limit of ourselves. It maps our boundaries.
If you'll give me a tobacco cigarette, Molly said with a shiver of fear, I'll stay too, but I'm dying for a cigarette.
That's nothing worth dying for, Joe said.
Let's die for this, even if we fall 10 stories into the basement doing it.
And the rest of you are staying, Glimmung said.
That's right,
a univalvular cephalopod squeaked. Uneasily, Harper Baldwin said, I'll stay, I guess.
Glimmung, with satisfaction, said, Then let us begin. At the curb before the Olympia Hotel, heavy-duty trucks had been parked. Each had a driver, and each driver knew what to do. A portly organism with a long, ropey tail approached Joe and Molly, a clipboard clutched energetically in its fuzzy paw.
You two are to go with me,
the organism declared, and then picked up from the group 11 more individuals.
That's a wourge, Molly said to Joe. Our driver. They can make excellent speed. Their reflexes are so acute. We'll be out on the promontory in the manner of a minute.
Matter of minutes, Joe corrected absently, as he seated himself on the bench in the rear segment of the truck. Other life forms squeezed in with Joe and Molly, and then the truck engine came noisily to life.
What kind of turbine is that? Joe said, annoyed by the noise it made.
A kindly-looking bivalve beside him groaned,
It's internal combustion. Bang, 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 all the way.
The frontier, Joe said, and felt an aching joy all at once. Yes, he thought, this is the frontier. We are back with Abraham Lincoln in a log cabin, and Daniel Boone, all of them, the old-time pioneers.
One by one, the trucks pulled away from the curb, their lights yellow in the night, like the orbs of luminous foreign moths.
Glimmung will be waiting for us, Molly said. When we get there.
She sounded tired.
He's capable of reflex relocation, based on automatic pulsations emanating from within his own neurological substructure. For all intents and purposes, he can move from one locus to another without time lapse.
She rubbed her eyes and sighed. The helpful bivalve spoke up once more.
The creature beside you, Mr. Fernwright, is truthful.
It extended a pseudo-podium to Molly. "Miss Yoyez, I am Nurb Koldak, from Sirius 3. We have all been waiting anxiously for your party to arrive, because we understood that once you reach the Hotel Olympia, all of us who have been waiting a long time can begin, as it seems to be so. But in addition, I am glad to become known to you and have you know me, in that I, for my part, will search out and locate the coral-encrusted objects, which will then be brought out of Mare Nostrum and brought to you at your shop. I am the engineer in charge of discrete artifacts and the transporting thereof on Mr. Nurbkoldak's request to your shop. A quasi-arachnid, brightly black in its chitinous exoskeleton, said. "You haven't done any preliminary work?" Molly asked. "While you waited?" "Glimmung kept us in our rooms," the bivalve explained. "We did two things. One, we read all pertinent documents relating to the history of Heldskala. Two, we watched on a video monitor as robot sensors scanned the sunken cathedral time and again. On our screens we have seen Heldskala countless times, but now we will be allowed to touch it." "I wish I could go to sleep," Molly said. She rested her close-cropped head on Joe's shoulder and slumped against him. "Wake me up when we get there." The quasi-arachnid said to Joe and the bivalve, "This total undertaking, it reminds me of an Earth saga, parts of which we were required to memorize during our educational years. It made a deep impression on me." "He means the Faust theme," the bivalve told Joe. "Faustian man, striving upward, never satisfied. Glimmung is like Faust in certain respects, unlike him in others." Rustling its antennae in agitation, the quasi-arachnid said, "Glimmung resembles Faust in all respects. The Faust, at least, of Goethe, which is the version I adhere to." Eerie, Joe thought. A chitinous multi-legged quasi-arachnid and a large bivalve with pseudopodia arguing about Goethe's Faust. A book which I've never read, and it originated on my planet, is the product of a human being. "Part of the difficulty," the quasi-arachnid was saying, "lies in the translation. It was written in a language which has died out." "German," Joe said. He knew that much, at least. "I have," the quasi-arachnid muttered, "made a..." It groped in a plastic utility pouch slung over its shoulder. Four of its manual extremities busily sorted through the pouch. "Damn thing," it muttered. "Everything sinks to the bottom. Here it is." It brought out a much-folded sheet of paper, which it proceeded to unfold carefully. "I have made my own translation into modern-day Terran, formerly called English. I will read you the crucial scene from the second part, the moment at last when Faust pauses in contemplation of what he has done and is content. Whatever the expression is. All right, Mr. Fernwright, sir?" "Sure," Joe said, as the truck rumbled along, over potholes and rocks, shaking and swaying the creatures within it. Molly now seemed to have totally fallen asleep. She had certainly been right about the driving skill of the Wourge. The truck rattled through the darkness at a great rate. "A swamp surrounds the mountains," the quasi-arachnid read from its carefully preserved sheet of paper. "Poisoning everything already reclaimed. To drain the foul marsh, this must be done. This would be the highest conquest possible. I'll open room for many millions. Not in any sense safe, but daily freed in which to live. Green the meadow and fruitful. Men and herds almost already on the most new earth, settled on the rim of which has been pushed up by bold people's efforts. Here within a paradise land that keeps outside the flood, and as it eats away, tries to enter and take over, a group will hurries to cut it off. Yes, this..." The bivalve interrupted the quasi-arachnid's earnest recitation. "Your translation is not idiomatic. Men and herds almost already on the most new earth. Grammatically it is correct, but no Terran talks like that." The bivalve waved a pseudo-podium toward Joe, seeking his support. "Isn't that so, Mr. Fernwright?" Joe thought, "Men and herds almost already on the most new earth." The bivalve was right, of course, but... "I like it," Joe said. Highly pleased, the quasi-arachnid yelped, "And see how much it resembles us and the Glimmung, the undertaking. Within here, a paradise land that keeps outside the flood. The flood is a symbol for everything that eats away structures which living creatures have erected. The water which has covered Heldskala. The flood won out many centuries ago, but now Glimmung is going to push it back.
a group will, which hurries to cut it off. That is all of us. Perhaps Goethe was a precog. Perhaps he foresaw the raising of Helvskalla.
The truck slowed.
We're there, the word's driver informed them.
He applied his brakes, and the truck came to a squeaking halt, causing everyone aboard to pitch violently.
Molly stirred, opened her eyes. She glanced around in each direction, panic shaping her face. Obviously, she could not orient herself immediately.
We're there, Joe said to her, and hugged her against him. And now it begins, he reflected, for better or worse, for richer, for poorer, until death, he thought. Do us part. Odd that he should think of that, the litany of the marriage vows. Yet it seemed to fit. Death in some indistinct form seemed to hover close by. Stiffly, he rose, helped Molly up. They and the others began creakily to get down from the back of the truck. The night air, with its smell of the sea, he took a deep breath. It is really close now, he realized. The sea, the cathedral. And Glimmung, trying to separate them, the sea pushed back from Helvskalla. Like God did, he thought. Separating the dark from the light, or however it goes, and the water from the land. To the quasi-arachnid he said, God in Genesis was very Faustian. Molly moaned. Good Lord, theology in the middle of the night. In the damp, cold air she shivered, peering around her. I don't see a damn thing. We're in the center of no place.
Against the dim nocturnal sky, Joe made out what appeared to be a geodesic dome. There it is, he said to himself.
The other trucks had arrived by now. All had stopped, and from each of them the throng of life forms emerged, each in its own peculiar fashion. Some helped others. The reddish jelly, for example, had a difficult time until a spiny apparition resembling a hostile bowling ball helped it down. A hovercraft, illuminated and large, manifested itself above them, gradually descending until at last it had parked itself in the midst of their group.
Hello, it said. I am your conveyance to your work areas. Board me carefully, and I will take you there if you would, please. Hello, hello.
Hello to you, too, Joe said to himself, as he and the rest of them slithered, flapped, and bumbled aboard. Inside the geodesic dome, they were met by a horde of robots. Joe stared in disbelief. Robots?
They're not illegal here, Molly pointed out. You must get it into your mind. You're not on Earth anymore.
Joe said, but Edgar Mahan proved that a synthetic life form can't come into existence. Life has to come from life, and therefore, in the construction of self-programming mechanisms...
Well, you're looking at 20 of them, Molly said.
Why were we told they couldn't be made? Joe asked her.
Because there are too many unemployed people on Earth as it is. The government faked scientific evidence and documentation to say robots couldn't be done. They are rare, however. They are hard to build and costly. I'm surprised to see this many. It is all he has, I'm sure. This is a...
She searched for the word.
For our benefit, a display, to impress us.
One of the robots, catching sight of Joe, coasted directly toward him.
Mr. Fernwright?
Yes, Joe said. He looked around him at the corridors and massive doors and the recessed overhead lighting. Efficient, extensive, and labyrinthine. And without defect. Obviously, it had just been built, and not yet put to use.
I'm amazingly glad to see you, the robot declared. In the center of my chest, you will probably see the word Willis stenciled. I am programmed to respond to any instruction beginning with that word. For example, if you would like to see your work area, merely say, Willis, I would like to be taken to my work area. And I would then happily lead you there, giving pleasure to myself and hopefully to you as well.
Willis, Joe said, are there living quarters here for us? For example, is there a private room for Miss Yoyez? She's tired. She should be asleep.
A three-room apartment is ready for you and Miss Yoyez, Willis said. Your personal living quarters.
What? Joe said.
A three-room apartment? You mean we have an actual apartment, not just a room?
A three-room apartment, Willis repeated with robotic patience.
Take us there, Joe said.
No, Willis said. You have to say, Willis, take us there.
Willis, take us there.
Yes, Mr. Fernwright. The robot led them across the foyer to the elevators.
After looking over the apartment, Joe got Molly into bed. She fell asleep without a sound. Even the bed was large. Everything in the apartment was solid and in good taste, of a modest sort, and the apartment itself was, like its contents, large. He could hardly believe it. He examined the kitchen, the living room, and found, in the living room, on a coffee table, a jar from Held Scala. As soon as he saw it, he knew what it was. Seating himself on the couch, he reached out and carefully picked it up. The deep yellow glaze. He had never seen such a rich yellow before. It surpassed even the yellows of Delft tiles. Surpassed, in fact, Royal Albert yellow. That made him wonder about bone china. Are there bone beds here? He asked himself. And if so, what percentage bone are they using? 60%? 40%? And are there bone beds as good as the people's bone bed in Moravia? Willis, he said. Yes, sir. Questioningly, Joe said, yes, sir. Why not yes, sir? The robot said, I just done been reading Earth history. Massa fun, right, sir? Are there bone beds here on Plowman's planet? Well, Massa fun, right? I don't rightly know. I guess that y'all can ask the central computator if I'm... I order you to talk correctly, Joe said. Y'all gotta say Willis first. If y'all want me to... Willis, talk correctly. Yes, Mr. Fernwright. Willis, can you take me to my work area? Yes, Mr. Fernwright. Okay, Joe said. Take me there. The robot unlocked a heavy steel and asbestos door and stood to one side, permitting Joe Fernwright to enter the enormous dark room. Overhead lights came on automatically as he crossed the threshold. He saw, at the far end of the room, a major workbench, and fully equipped. Three sets of Waldos, glare-free lighting which operated from a pedal console, self-focusing magnifying glasses, 15 inches and more in diameter. The separate heat needles, all the known sizes. To the left of the workbench he saw protective cartons, a kind which he had read about but never seen. Going over, he picked one up, dropped it experimentally, and watched it float downward, gently landing, without impact. And the sealed containers of glazes. Every tint, shade, and hue was represented. The row of containers lined one side of the room in four rows. With them, he could match virtually the glazes of every pot coming onto his bench. One more item. He walked over to it and inspected it with wonder. A weightless area where gravity was balanced by a ring of invisible counterspin. This was the ultimate workshop device for a pot healer, this weightless area. He would not need to secure the pieces of pot in order to meld them together. The pieces in the weightless chamber would simply remain where he put them. By means of this, he could handle four times the number of pots he had turned out in former times. And those were times of prosperity. And the positioning would be absolutely exact. Nothing would slip, slide, or tilt during the healing process. He noted, too, the kiln, which might be needed if a shard were missing and the need to create a duplicate came into being. Thus, he could complete pots of which he did not have all the pieces. This aspect of the craft of pot healing was not generally dealt with publicly, but it existed. Never in his life had he seen such a well-equipped shop for pot healing. Already, a number of broken pots had been brought in. A pile of filled protective cartons had accumulated at the incoming end of the bench. I could start right now, he realized. All I have to do is flip a half dozen switches and I'm in business. Tempting. He walked over to the rack of heat needles, took one down, held it. Well balanced, he decided. Quality product, the best. He opened one of the filled cartons, gazed down at the potsherds. His interest became emergent instantly. Setting down the heat needle, he took the shards out one by one, enjoying the glazes and the glazed texture of the pot. A short, fat pot. A funny pot, perhaps. He put the pieces back in the carton and turned, with the idea of carrying them over to the weightless area. He wanted to begin. This was his life. Never did I think, he thought, that I would have access to the use of... He halted, and felt inside as if some animal had gnawed at his heart. Gnawed it with greed. And delight. A black figure, like a negative of life itself, stood facing him. It had been watching him, and now that he faced it, he thought it would go away. But it remained. He waited a little longer. It still remained. What is this thing? He asked the robot, who still stood at the threshold of the workroom. You have to say Willis first, the robot reminded him. You have to say, Willis, what?
Willis, he said, what is it?
A calend, the robot said.